Welcome to Tufts Center for the Arts Radio Hour. I'm Chelsea Reedy. This show is supported by the National Endowment for the Humanities. Today, we're thinking about libraries, and our two guests, Mimosa Shaw and Kate Aldorete, talk about what libraries mean for the public and how libraries have been operating during the pandemic. First, we'll hear from Mimosa Shaw. She is the Adult Program Coordinator at Skokie Public Library in Skokie, Illinois. And a little later, Crystal Starr talks with Kate Aldorete, Director of Taos Public Library. For the past 6 years, Mimosa Shaw has managed, developed, and evaluated informal learning opportunities for adults in the community. She is also pursuing a master's degree in library and information sciences through the University of Illinois School of Information. Mimosa is deeply involved with the Museum Computer Network, a learning organization dedicated to digital transformation of museums. Here's Colette LaBeouf talking with Mimosa Shaw.
I know you just started a library science master's degree. Master's in library science?
It's a master of science in library information sciences.
There you go. Okay, so it's close. And is that already started?
It has, yes.
And how's it going?
It's busy. It's an online degree program that I'm taking through the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign's iSchool. It has been very interesting for me as a slightly older student, as well as a student who is not accustomed in working in an entirely online modality.
Absolutely.
And like many other students across the country, I am encountering it for the first time. Mm-hmm. And while this program has been established and been doing online learning for many years now, I don't think they've done it with the same volume because of the pandemic, which has led to many people seeking out online contact or being forced to seek out online content via schooling because their classes are not meeting in person.
You are a programming coordinator for adult programs at Skokie.
Yes.
Library. Can you talk about what you do there and what is your role at Skokie?
So I develop, manage, and evaluate public programming for adults, but that really doesn't get to the heart of what I actually do, which is I have the unique privilege and joy to collaborate with a cohort of wonderful colleagues who work in three different departments and who have a myriad of backgrounds and interests to develop public events that are also tied very closely with community interests and concerns. And we frequently do collaborations with community partners. Of course, with the outbreak of the pandemic, it has been harder to do precisely this work in the way that we want to do it. We are hopeful, though, that we can continue to offer online events throughout the pandemic and instill, by doing that, cultivate connections with our community members, because our library does not function without it, the warmth and dynamism of our community.
So, you know, just to give our audience some context, tell us about Skokie, how big it is, what kind of place it is, and then in the context of that, the size of the library too.
Skokie is is what we would often refer to as a ring suburb, meaning that it is adjacent to a larger metropolis, and Skokie is adjacent to the city of Chicago. Itself has approximately a population of 65,000 individuals, but the library serves a broader community area with patrons typically coming in from neighboring suburbs like Evanston or Morton Grove or Niles, as well as patrons coming from the city of Chicago to use our resources and spaces and to periodically meet with one another. We, of course, due to the pandemic, can't do things in the same level we once did, but we still continue to see patrons from these surrounding areas use other parts of the library, whether it's attending an online event or trying to work with their own library to get some type of resource, and sometimes connecting with librarians through our website to find out what resources they could potentially share out, and then what that patron in turn can find at their immediate suburban library, for example. As far as Skokie itself, the demographics of the community are very diverse. We have multiple languages being spoken throughout the households of Skokie. We have more than 40% of our population as of the last census count in 2010, which is not up to date, of course, be foreign born. A sizable group of our patrons are recently arrived immigrants, refugees, or second generation immigrants who have either lived in this community or have migrated to this community after living elsewhere in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. There is also a historic Jewish population and diaspora that resides in Skokie to this very day, as well as a growing community of Muslims from places like Bangladesh, Pakistan, and other parts of Southwest Asia.
Wow.
You asked me about the library itself, and I neglected to mention. So the library is a single branch location. It is three floors, the first two floors of which are open to the public. And the building is also undergoing a renovation. So different parts of the building are closed off while construction is taking place. Mm-hmm. It is approximately 133,000 square feet without any of these barriers. It is a lovely building that was first built and opened to the public in 1960, with additions that were made to the building in the mid-1970s and then later in the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. The current renovation does not add anything more to the building, but rather is adaptations and renovations taking place on the interior so that it is more accessible and responsive to what and how we've seen community members use the space and what they've desired from it.
You know, just listening to, just getting a picture of the population, the community, the building itself, the scope or and the size of it. I mean, I think about this a lot, you know, when we're within an institution or with when we're within a kind of work or a path, and we think a lot about, you know, what is it that we do? Who is it for? And what is it for? And I've spent a lot of time thinking about libraries as well. And I'm curious about, from your perspective, doing programming for adults and serving a community, what is the library for?
Oh, Colette, the ontological questions, right? What is a library without its public, especially in a time of pandemic? First and foremost, historically, libraries have been a place where people can truly be active participants in what we know as the democratic experience known as America. It's an experience as well as an experiment. And the ideal is that the library, capital L library, is a place where people can explore and ideas of all kinds and all perspectives. And at the same time, they have the ability to express all kinds of ideas from all perspectives. And that they can convene with others to discuss and to connect with these ideas. Now, thinking about little L library, what that means in this day and age is that we still function as places for the commingling and exploration of ideas, and we still do our darndest to provide access to this, even when we are limited in terms of our physical location. But we also exist to connect and to inspire and to provide avenues for creation, even if we are limited by what tools we can use to approach that and to do so in a safe manner, we are still committed to that, to those values.
And then all of this, big L library, small L, add the pandemic in and it changes even more, right? I'm curious about, if you could give me an example of the kind of program that you were providing before the pandemic and how you've adjusted and how you've accommodated. I mean, I know that there are virtual events before the pandemic, but I know you've also thought a lot about how to serve your community since then.
Yes, of course. So as we know, after 7 months going into, at least for me, working from home, that what happened in person does not translate equally to a digital experience. So a great example of that is the library would periodically host what we call the Civic Lab, which is a pop-up experience where different members from our Civic Lab curatorial team would pop up in the library with a rotating display of some materials from our collection, books, movies. They would also provide a useful, somewhat less esoteric LibGuide, a resource sheet essentially, for how to step in and learn about this topic. So for example, we would have a Civic Lab in which we would talk about She Did That. What does that mean? And it was actually a tie-in to the many types of accomplishments of women and how they were not necessarily recognized. And so the purpose of that pop-up was to share resources and information for patrons to explore this topic more deeply and to potentially come to their own conclusions as to why is it that women are overlooked in history? Why is it that women are not recognized more often in the sciences? We try to provide resources that appeal to various ages, and we have staff typically at these pop-ups who are there to facilitate conversation, because we found that a static exhibition in itself was not enough for people to stop by and to talk and to ponder and to really engage with what we were sharing. Mm-hmm. Now, that event can't take place in the same way. We tried to do it in person, Civic Lab, with masks and distance, but we also found that there were other ways to intervene and to do a Civic Lab using different platforms. So we actually use Zoom as well as Instagram Live to do Civic Lab chats. The ones that we do via Zoom are not pop-up in the pure sense. Rather, they are registration-based. The ones that take place on Instagram Live, again, not a pure pop-up, but they are things that people can drop in and hear too. Library staff members talk about a particular pressing theme. Right now, we are doing a series on elections 2020, and we've been using the Zoom events as a way to parse out different aspects of voting. Why do we vote? How does one vote? What are the implications of voter suppression? We have several team members that will be facilitating a chat, as well as several team members who are monitoring the chat box itself to engage with patrons. We also provide an editable document so that patrons can lend their responses and the resources they're using so that they can also engage with us more directly. And they can also choose, if they wish to turn on their video or their mic to talk, to ask questions, and to essentially connect, whether with us or with one another. So that's an example of how we adapted a pop-up experience into other possibilities. And I'd be happy to share with you several examples of that.
That was Mimosa Shaw talking with Colette LaBeouf. Going into the break, here's some music from Ben Bogart and Winnie Chung off their 2020 album, La Proxima Traición. Ben on the bandoneon and Winnie on the piano pay homage to tango's tradition of revolutionary innovation. The duo describes it as a dumping out of the drawer, to reorganize or declutter, socially, politically, and artistically. They say, to us, the most important part is turning the everyday upside down. Stay with us. Welcome back to TCA Radio Hour. Colette LaBeouf continues the conversation with Mimosa Shaw. Shaw's work alternates between the analog and digital, with interests that include media literacy and ways to deal with mis- and disinformation campaigns, digital photography, and how we use various platforms to share, archive, and work against the constraints they sustain, zine making and paper arts that memorialize stories that deserve to be documented, and space making for and with communities marginalized by aspects of their identities. Here's Mimosa Shaw talking with Colette LaBeouf.
So I'm thinking also particularly about Skokie, and I know you guys have a real winter as Taos does. But I also traditionally think of libraries as space that is safe. And for families, for adults, for children to come in and, as you said, in that big L sense, explore and find things, but also to be inside and to be safe in some ways, whatever those ways might be. How is that for you as someone who creates programs for adults also?
Right. So adults can be anywhere between the age of 20 to 100 with very different life experiences,
yes,
and concerns and strategies that they have maybe developed over time to address those very concerns. Mm-hmm. I think ultimately it is always recognizing that people have, especially adults, have a wealth of experience and knowledge that they bring with them wherever they go, and to try to recognize and reconcile what's happening at any event, whether online or in person, with the fact that people are coming to this with a range of perceptions, and this is what you're presenting, what you're sharing is just one aspect. Mm-hmm. When it comes to safety, that's a very interesting concept, because I think that for so long, libraries have not always been the safest of places for certain populations that are underrepresented or marginalized. So there were actually libraries, public libraries, that had explicit rules about who could use the space. There were not as many library facilities for people who were Black, and therefore had to use different, less equipped, less staff spaces. There were sit-ins that were done by young Black people in order to get attention drawn to the fact that they had segregated library resources and therefore could not fully participate in the same democratic procedures and processes that make America what it is. But that's just one small example. Mm-hmm. And right now, you know, we are facing a crisis in which we cannot necessarily provide for that physical in-person safety due to the pandemic. This doesn't even get to some of the larger questions around how can libraries champion and support other ways of knowing and being. With that in mind, though, safety is something that is forefront for so many of us, and we always try to provide loving support and care with the things that we do. How that is expressed and how that is done, particularly through programs, is something that I do think about a lot. How can we be more anti-oppressive? Mm-hmm. How can we be more recognizing of the persons that are there, mm-hmm, whether or not they want to necessarily engage with us in the ways that will enable that recognition, like, I see you. How do you help people be seen and heard? And that's something that I think about a lot in terms of safety, right now especially, when people may feel powerless.
So Mimosa, thinking about, you know, this very, it's a very intense job, responsibility, and creative also, but you also have this this life as a colleague with other colleagues that you are very active and involved with in exploring these ideas and working with other people outside your institution. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so I have also been very interested in and engaged with a couple of other communities to explore what it's like to to aim for digital transformation. So for example, one of the organizations I've been involved with is Museum Computer Network, also known as MCN. They have an annual conference in which they explore the latest trends and concerns with regards to all things digital in the GLAM sector, so galleries, libraries, archives, and museums. And so I've been involved with fellow folks on a wonderful program committee to devise and reimagine what it would be like to have an in-person conference take place entirely online. And so that has been one thing I've been thinking about a lot. I'm also actively involved with a couple of other interventions, most memorably through a reading group that meets on Sundays, in which we just make space for and share our experiences of reading, writing, responding to things around us.
I think it really helps. Also, when you're having to create programming or devise or even just conceptualize programming that is virtual in all these ways, cannot be in person, that you're participating as well, receiving it, and an active participant yourself to kind of understand what it's like for you, for anybody. I mean, I feel that all the time as I do this, like here we are on Zoom interviewing. I would much rather go have coffee with you in Skokie.
Likewise, I'd love to be in Taos.
but here we are, and as programmers, I mean, as someone who's serving a community, I mean, you learn also as you go by doing that, I'm sure.
Yes, there's a lot of things that we're learning as we go along with this process. Things that we recognize, oh, that didn't work as well as we thought.
Right.
Moments of silence that feel like eons in digital time, when in fact, in real life, it wouldn't feel that way. Time is compressed and expanded in ways that we haven't quite found out how to reckon with right now. And that's very much due to the fact that we don't have the same things that mark off our days, mm-hmm. whether it's that lunch break or that thing that we see on our commute, on the ride to work, or the very real engagement that we have, even if it's something as simple as going to a grocery store and seeing the same cashier and having the same person bag your groceries at the same time of each week. There's something to be said for certain patterns of how we live that have been fully interrupted. And now, what do we use to mark off time and space? Mm-hmm. As opposed to experiencing it as one mm-hmm. long, unending day.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. So, you know, even though it's not in your bio, will you say you are an artist also. You're a movie lover and a photographer and a scholar too of these things. Can you talk about, and this has nothing to do with the library. Can you talk about what you're talking about, those things that have changed, you know, those daily things that have changed for us out of our work routine and our shopping routines and our sustenance, you're still taking pictures. How has that changed in the pandemic?
Oh, goodness. My palette and the locales of where I take photos are very limited. It doesn't feature vacation photos. It is merely photos that I take of the everyday, of walks that I take, of things that I encounter, of scenes to remind myself I am here. I am deeply inspired by other artists like yourself, Colette, who also take the time to really understand, like, what does a particular moment mean in the space of so many moments, who document life and all of its textures. And I feel a similar affinity and desire to do so. It's, yes, it could be one way to bide the time, but it's also another way to be very human. There's so much right now that that takes away or grates at our humanity. We can't be human in the presence of one another. And so for me, making any art, even if it's just for me and nobody else to see, is a way to reconcile and reconnect with what's human in me.
That was Colette LaBeouf talking with Mimosa Shaw. Find out more about Skokie Public Library and their digital programs at skokielibrary.info. That's S-K-O-K-I-E. Next, Crystal Starr talks with Kate Alderete, director of Taos Public Library. Alderete is from Las Vegas, New Mexico, and took the job at Taos Public Library in June of 2019. Alderete started out as a children's librarian in her hometown.
Do you want to give a little short history about the Taos Library and,
sure.
and how you became a part of the Taos Library?
People lived here for a while, actually, probably know the history better than I do. The library started at the Harwood House, which is now, of course, owned by UNM Taos and is the Harwood Museum. Like most small town little libraries, like, you know, in New Mexico, it started off as a reading room, and it moved to becoming like a flourishing lending library. And it was utilized as a library up until the 90s, which is really interesting, where it was a gallery, a museum, and a library. So a lot of stuff in one somewhat small building. So in the 90s, there was a lot of work done to have the town of Taos acquire the public library, which is usually, it's fairly typical in municipalities to be the umbrella under which a library sits. The land that we sit on now was donated by the town of Taos. The Friends of the Harwood Museum and Library were able to raise enough funds to put us in this building, and we've been here ever since. You know, the 90s weren't that long ago. So we have people in the community that utilized the library when it was still in the Harwood. We just had our last employee who was working at the Harwood just retire. So we even had, you know, someone here who has been with the library since it was in that building, which was kind of cool, like sort of a legacy person in this library. I got here, I'm originally from New Mexico. I'm just down the road in Las Vegas. So I grew up in a small municipal town, like a lot of people in Taos. I grew up and I left New Mexico and Las Vegas, and I was away for about 15 years, and I spent 10 years in Denver, which is where I got my master's degree in library science. And I decided to come back to New Mexico when I realized that I was about to have a baby and I wanted to be closer to my family and closer to my mother. We tend to take for granted when we live in small towns, then go off to big cities. There's so much to do in big cities, but like having your child close to you is one of the reasons that I wanted to be back in a smaller place. And I do have her close to me. I mean, we, you know, we live close to her school and to my work. And so it makes life definitely a lot easier.
So can you tell us a little bit about how libraries acquire books, encyclopedias, some of the historical stuff that you all house?
Sure. Essentially, when we acquire our material, we go through a couple of different processes. So things like encyclopedias that will like very quickly and easily update, we've moved to an online model, and that's most libraries. Like if you just think about a collection of hardback encyclopedias, they take up a lot of room, they're obsolete like very quickly. So we kind of have all, as far as libraries go, move to the digital platform on that kind of stuff. We're lucky enough to have a special collection room here that has been harvested and housed since the Harwood. We have books that are from the Harwood to this building that pertain to Taos and the history of Taos. And so when things like that come out, typically they're like locally published, or anything that pertains to the Southwest or New Mexico or Taos in general, we're going to get like notice of that. And we usually purchase one or two copies just depending on what it is. But then as far as how we, you know, acquire our general collection, this library, which is a little bit different than other libraries I've worked in, we actually hand pick what we buy, which has been, you know, really kind of fun. And, you know, it's time consuming, but like, just to know that like you had a hand in picking what someone is going to read is really kind of cool. So the way we do that is we generally look at like prolific writers. So we make sure that we get like our David Baldacci's and, you know, our John Grisham books and all of those writers that write and write and write. And then we look at like buzzworthy books. And again, those typically they throughout our different outlets, we learn about them. Like I'm thinking now about the new Alice Munro novel that just came out. It's a prequel to Practical Magic. So of course it's a book that people are going to want to read. So we make sure we get things like that. And then we move to like what's going on in the political sphere and in the nonfiction world. Right now, there's quite a bit going on in the political spheres. You know, we collect books. The Mary Trump book comes to mind. The Bob Woodward books come to mind. And then we acquire all of that information by looking to people beyond ourselves. We read professional journals. I like to read blogs. I like to look to book reviewers. My favorite is Ron Charles from the Washington Post. His recommendations are really tight and easy to figure out if our community is going to like a book by his recommendation. So I like to look at his stuff, and I'll just be totally blunt. I usually just buy it if he recommends it because he's a fantastic book reviewer. Finally, and probably most importantly, we listen to what our patrons want. So this library allows patrons to make requests directly to the directors. When we were open, we had like little blue slips, and anybody who's done this knows what it is. And you fill out what it is and you let us know when it was published. And I take a look at that. And usually more often than not, it's a book that I've either overlooked or haven't heard of, or an author that I haven't seen. And it fits right into like what our collection looks like here in Taos. So that's one of the tools that I've had the opportunity to utilize is you know, the people here who utilize our library and read.
That was Kate Alderete talking with Crystal Starr. When we come back, more from Alderete about libraries as a resource for the community. Stay with us. I'm Chelsea, and this is TCA Radio Hour. We've been talking about libraries today, earlier with Mimosa Shaw of Skokie Public Library in Skokie, Illinois, and now with Kate Alderete, Director of Taos Public Library. Alderete earned a master's degree in Library and Information Science from the University of Denver. She returned to her home state of New Mexico to be close to family when her new baby was on the way. Here, she describes all different facets of Taos Public Library's operations.
I know you all have a lot of textiles all the time hanging from the ceiling. This just crossed my mind, so I'm sorry to just throw you a curveball.
No, it's
but,
fine, yeah.
You know, that is something else that I appreciate about large and small scale libraries is the representation, right, and the platform for art. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I think one of the things that people overlook about libraries is that we aren't just a building filled with books. Really what we are, you know, libraries are absolutely community centers, and in a community like Taos, that absolutely includes art. So one of the things that we were doing throughout the year while our building was open was hanging quilt shows. So we had, if you're familiar with a library, you could walk in on any given month and there would be a quilt show hanging up, which I always loved. It was always really cool it just brought so much color and energy and life into the building itself. Beyond that, you know, there's art all over this building. We have in our Southwest collection, we feature local artists. There's art hanging everywhere. There's art outside of our building. It speaks so highly of what Taos is. Like, we, you know, at our core, one of the things that Taos represents is art.
Yeah. So the average person, you know, to the average person, library seems very cut and dry, right? You can go in, you can rent a book, you can utilize a computer. Do you have some other unknown or less known facts about libraries, maybe specifically Taos Library in general, that people may not be aware of?
There's very few people in this world who've never used a library service or walked into a library. So there's like this stigma of what a library is. It's books, it's computers, it's librarians that are shushing people, and just things that sometimes are true, but other times are not. So I kind of actually made a list on this question of like what are lesser known things that we are. And I think for now, one of the most resonant things is that libraries have been working on a digital platform long before COVID-19. There's like this idea that we jumped into this world that we're totally unfamiliar with like our Zoom programs and things like that. But frankly, it's not true. We're all very well versed in the tool of the internet and what we can use and utilize to provide services beyond things like Overdrive, which is our digital platform for ebooks and audiobooks and even movies. We have been working with databases. I couldn't give you the exact number, but I would say that most libraries moved to the digital platform on databases like in the late 90s. So like I mentioned, things like encyclopedias, all of that is digital now. And librarians are the people who know really how to quickly find information for you on that platform. I just fielded a question for one of my patrons on things, something that I would never know anything about, which was like car maintenance, but we have a database for that. So like things that like I can, point to help people questions.
Did you say car maintenance?
Car maintenance. Yeah. Something that like, I know where the gas gauge is. That's like how my knowledge of car information, but I know how to navigate a database because I'm a librarian. Our databases also include things like academic resources for students, and that's students of any level. So if you're an elementary student, we have Britannica and it like goes by levels. If you're new to English, we have, we have levels that you can kind of look at to find information and good information. It's not information that you yourself have to curate. Like, so if you type something into Google, you have to be the person who actually says this is good information, this is bad information. But when you do it into a library database, it's all good information. So that's, that's helpful. And I did want to mention one, as far as our digital platforms, I'm trying to let parents know that we have this for them, especially now that school has moved on to, during the pandemic, into the homeschool version of life for kids. We have a database called BrainFuse, and it is live tutors on the other end of your computer. But I guess, so the other things that I think people sometimes think about us but don't really like get is that librarians have answers. Like I mentioned, we may not know everything, but we know how to find answers for you. So if you have questions, you should come to a library. If you are trying to figure something out and you're at your wit's end and you're totally frustrated, there's a whole staff of people in this building that can help you with that question. And that's part of the reason that we're in this space, because that's what we do as a public service. I think one of the other things that people forget about libraries, and you hear this all the time, and I mean, people hear this all the time, like, well, libraries are, they're eventually going to fold because of, they used to say Borders, the bookstore, if you can imagine that. And then they said other big platforms, Amazon is going to fold libraries, the internet is going to fold libraries. Well, that doesn't happen. That never happened. Libraries are the one of the oldest institutions in the entire world. Librarians are, I like to say, the oldest profession in the world. There's some, sometimes people disagree with me there, but I like to say
that. I could believe that though. I mean, someone had to run it. If it's the oldest institution,
right.
Someone had to run it, right?
Someone didn't.
Yeah.
In this country, and this is a little different, and it's kind of funny in Taos because it's exactly, well, actually it isn't equal. There are more libraries in this country than there are Starbucks. And if you look at our little region, we have Tulpa, we have Taos, and we have one Starbucks. So there's that. And anywhere you go, if you go to bigger cities, there Starbucks are on every corner, and so are libraries. I mean, it's like our goal here, period. Our first and foremost goal is to ensure that we can provide access to equitable information for anybody. So we don't discriminate. Like, that's why you come into this building and you see such a diverse, patronship. Like, we see people who are unhoused. We see people who are second homeowners here. Like, our goal is to make sure that if you walk into our building, that you leave with whatever you need. The last thing that I think that people should know about their libraries, and sometimes they don't, is that when you walk into a library, you absolutely have not just a reasonable right to, but you have a legal obligation by us to your privacy. So if you want to read something that your partner may not agree with, or your parents may not agree with, or anything like that, you are 100% safe here. Your privacy is one of our goals.
Could you talk a little bit about how people use the library as a place to escape the heat or the cold or the elements? Yeah. I'm sure you all. Yeah.
Oh, definitely. There's like a common saying in youth librarianship that one of the reasons we can get a lot of teens in the summer is because of the air conditioning. And it's true. I mean, we're a safe building. We're a warm building, a cool building in the summer. We're a place to get out of the elements if you are in the elements. And we are, again, one of the only institutions in the world that don't expect anything from you. So, you know, you can't really walk into a McDonald's or a restaurant or anything if you don't have, you know, some money to buy some food or whatever. But you can come in here and you can, you know, warm up and read and spend the day here if you need to, or anything. So it doesn't matter who you are. I mean, period. It just does not. Libraries during this COVID closure have really had to struggle with the fact that we did provide a building and a safe haven for not, and, you know, I think when I say this to a lot of people, they're going to think, oh, the unhoused population in Taos, right. But that's not always true. You know, we have young mothers here who come in for story time and for just like, you know, I'm a young mother, like some relief, like some entertainment for your child. We have, you know, teens who utilized our space after school because their parents worked. Like, you know, we have a high tourist population. We had tourists who wanted to see what our town was actually about. And you figure that out in a library.
We know that everyone has had to adjust in some way to restrictions due to COVID-19. How's the library managed that? I know you all have a system, and I appreciate it. It's great. I think it's amazing what you all are doing, but I'm sure a lot of people may not know what you all have done and how the citizens or the community can access the library right now.
When we closed March 13th, and really the whole country kind of closed like during that weekend. It was Friday the 13th, which mm-hmm. is always going to resonate in my head. because it's really weird to wake up one day. And like, besides the fact that we're all coping with this pandemic that was, you know, that was sort of underplayed until it wasn't. But then you wake up and you're a public librarian and you don't have a public to serve. And it's, you know, so it was kind of shocking. But once we kind of got over that initial shock, we moved very quickly to utilizing our online platforms. And like I said, you know, we adapted quickly, but all of these things are not new to us. So we opened up and let our let anybody in the community get what we call a provisional card, which allows full access to OverDrive. And OverDrive is our digital platform for ebooks and audiobooks and movies. We did see a consistent rise in our OverDrive numbers before the closure until even now. We're still seeing like I think it's about a 25% increase in what we were lending. Then we moved to providing some of our community programming on a digital platform. So the second thing we did is we bought a Zoom license and we all got familiar with Zoom. And our children's librarian moved all of her story times to Zoom. We had a couple of things that got canceled on her end. And one of them was the paint and sip for her teens, it was cocoa and painting. We were kind of easily able to adapt that into a hybrid, mailed all of her stuff out. And then she got on Zoom and she painted with her teens, which we've kind of like adapted. It's been a couple of months to figure out what works best. And then I should say that our entire children's program on like the mail and stuff, libraries do a summer reading program. It's a nationwide program. It's on the exact same thing for every library, same theme, I'm sorry, on every library. And it's one of the requirements for us to receive state grants. So our summer reading program is really important. It's planned by March. So we had the whole thing essentially done and we had to revamp it to make it a hybrid mail in, email in, Zoom, live on Facebook, recorded on Facebook program. And so, you know, I have a wonderful children's librarian and she adapted very quickly and got all of that done. And we had numbers that were close to what we had last year as like, a, you know, the the one-on-one, face-to-face, open building summer reading program. I try to see silver linings in life in general. Mm-hmm. And I think that COVID has, you know, has moved everything to a digital platform. And in a lot of ways, that has made a lot of things that are inaccessible to people accessible. And so I think about kids that have working parents, that there's no way that their parents can get here on a weekday for a summer reading program. It's just not going to happen. Well, those kids got to participate this year because everything was sent to their home, you know,
yeah.
Or it was made live, it was made available on Facebook so they could look at it anytime. And it's still up on Facebook. Parents and families who want something to, who want to show their kids something educational and free, that's there for them. We're trying to roll out more adult programs, more teen programs, because I think we're all kind of settling into the fact that even if our building does open at, I mean, and it will at some point, we still are in the midst of a pandemic. And so we still need to be careful. So like, knowing that these things are still going to be available and ongoing, the library staff and myself have moved to that idea and that platform. We're going to keep our online and digital stuff flowing and going. And the last thing that we moved to was our curbside services and our curbside pickup. For the most part, anybody who's used it, I think they know that it's a pretty smooth little transition.
And it very much is. I have used it.
Yeah.
And you all are great.
Good. And we're trying to make it accessible and easy. And, you know, with limited staff, like we're trying to make it so our patrons can have access to the collection, because there's a lot of things that we do, but at the very base, a library is information and we have that information.
Yeah. Because and for some of us, we still love holding the book.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah. Definitely.
I don't read books online just because I love to see books in my house, one, mm-hmm, but I also mm-hmm. love turning the page, you know, and yeah. not being on a screen.
Yeah. Not being on a screen. And I think there's like a quality to like actually reading a book, and you know, pictures are always usually better if you're reading something nonfiction with like a section of pictures or storybooks for kids. That's always like different, and it's good to, you know, textually hold something. If you don't mind, I can explain a little bit about what we're doing with our book drop. So So our book drop is open one day a week. Originally, it was open earlier in the week, and now we moved it to Thursdays, and it's open from 8:30 to 4. And we did that to correspond with the curbside pickup. So Thursdays, 8:30 to 4. So we've gotten a lot of questions on why we can't open it up more than one day a week. The reasoning for that is we have to quarantine our books for 6 days. There's a very trusted library organization called OCLC, and they ran a bunch of tests in a lab that showed what COVID-19 actually looks like on surfaces. I think we're all settling into pandemic life, but when you read something like COVID-19 from a sneeze on a page can live for up to 6 days, be active, find a host, and infect someone. When you read that, it's like jaw-dropping. It's like, we are like, this is serious. So in response to that reporting that came out by OCLC, and that report is also available on our website for anybody who wants to read it. That's the reasoning why. And I know that it can be really frustrating. I fully get that. There's a lot of different reasons for the one day beyond the 6 days quarantine. The other thing is that this library is actually pretty small. So we don't have, you know, I couldn't do it more than one day a week because we don't have space to actually quarantine those books and stay away from them. So that's kind of the reasoning. We do get a lot of questions. I fully know that it's frustrating, and I fully understand. Our goal is right now, as far as curbside and returning books, is that if you want something, get it. Stress-free, come get it.
Yeah.
and bring it back. Stress-free, bring it back when you can.
That was Kate Alderete talking with Crystal Starr. TCA Radio Hour is brought to you in part by our local business partner, Casa Gallina, and by the National Endowment for the Humanities, Exploring the Human Endeavor. And thank you to KNCE 93.5 FM, streaming live at truthouseradio.com. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in this program do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. This has been Taft Center for the Arts Radio Hour. I'm Chelsea. Thanks so much for tuning in. Have a great day.